start.
Be a rebel start.
I'm going to start a little bit early because we'll review very briefly where we left off yesterday, because we kind of left off mid-thought. I'm sorry? Okay, I'm sorry. We're on today's daf is Kuf Chof, and we're going to be on the bottom of Kuf Yud Tes. We'll start four lines up, but before we start inside, I'll just say outside what was in the Mishnah. So the Mishnah discussed the following case, where you had two brothers who are married to two women. So we'll call them brother one and two, and woman one and two. They went overseas, all four of them, and both women came back saying that their husbands had died. None of these men had children, and so the issue is as follows, that we discussed in the Mishnah that woman one is believed to say that her husband died, and woman two is believed to say that her husband died, so therefore, theoretically, they could go out and get remarried. The issue is that because their husbands had no children, they're zakuk liyibum, so woman one is zakuk to her brother-in-law, which is brother two, and woman two is zakuk to brother one. And the issue is as follows, that we learned on Kuf Yud Zayin that certain people aren't believed because they have some kind of ulterior motive, or we're worried that they're trying to mess over their tzara, or in this case, it's their husband's brother's wife, i.e. their sister-in-law, and that therefore the sister-in-law is not believed to say that the brother-in-law died, because generally speaking, that's a person who's not believed. So that was the case in the Mishnah. They basically said, because although they're each believed that their husband died, that because they're not believed, they can't believe their sister-in-law, they have no proof that their yavam died, and therefore they're in a situation where they're stuck. So that was the first case in the Mishnah. The Mishnah then had some in-between cases. At the end, the Mishnah describes another case, which is, what happens if you had that same scenario, brother one and two married to woman one and two, but there also is brother three and four. And so the Mishnah described the scenario where woman one married, did Yibum with brother three. Again, the fact that brother two, for the purpose of woman one, the fact that brother two, we don't know whether he's dead or not, doesn't make a difference, because she could do Yibum with any of the brothers. So woman one did Yibum with brother three, and woman two did Yibum with brother four. Then brother three and four died. That's the scenario there. And so the Machlokas in the end of the Mishnah was the following, that the Tanakhama said that once brother three and four died, they're back in the same problem, because they now have to do yibum from their brother three and four. And let's take the case of woman one. She was married to brother three. She still doesn't know. She has no proof that brother two died, and therefore she's zakuk liyibum. So she's back in the same conundrum she was in the first case in the Mishnah. Rabbi Elazar says, no. Once they married brothers three and four, that they're no longer stuck, and therefore they can go ahead and get married to any person. So that was the machlokas at the end of the Mishnah, and we're going to start off in the Gemara, four lines from the bottom, which we're going to try to understand what is the rationale of Rebbe Elazar that he says once they married brothers three and four, that then they can go out and marry anyone in the world, and they're not back in the same pickle they were to begin with. Bai Rava. Rava asks, my time with Rebbe Elazar. What's the reason of Rebbe Elazar? And he gives two choices. Is it mishum de kasavar tzara me'ida lechaverta? Is it because Rabbi Elazar is of the opinion that a tzara, in this case we're not speaking specifically about a tzara, where again we're talking about the sister-in-law who's generally not believed. Maybe Rabbi Elazar believes that the sister-in-law is believed. We spoke out yesterday from Tosos, that Tosos asked the question and says, well, wait, if Rabbi Elazar is of the opinion that we do trust the sister-in-law, he should have argued on Kuf Yud Zayin. Why did he wait until this Mishnah to argue? So Tosos understands that Rabbi Elazar agrees with the basic concept that a sister-in-law is not believed, but he says in a certain circumstance it's different, which is what? That if the woman is testifying and her primary purpose is testifying is for herself, so in this case, woman one is testifying that her husband died, that's because she wants to go out and be able to get remarried. She's not testifying specifically on behalf of her sister-in-law. So in that case, if the sister-in-law is just an ancillary beneficiary of the testimony that the woman gives, in that case, Rabbi Elazar would say she's believed. That's option number one to understand Rabbi Elazar's opinion. Oh, Dilma, or perhaps the reason of Rabbi Elazar is not that reason, but rather mishum dehila mekalko nafsho. But rather that if she's demonstrated through her actions that she trusts her own testimony in a way that if she's found to be lying, she'll be messed over, in that case, We're going to believe her even for her sister-in-law. So what does that mean? So in other words, in this case where she went ahead, woman one went ahead and married brother three, so if she did that on the basis of her own testimony that she said her husband died, if it turned out that her husband hadn't really died, A, she would have been pagaya and eshesach. She would have gotten married to her to the brother's wife, which is an Isser Deraisa and an Isser Kares, and B, all of those penalties that we talked about, you know, maybe 20 blot or so ago, you know, would come onto her. So therefore, if in fact she's lying, she's at peril herself of being messed over. So we say, in a case where she actually took an action to back up her words, and she's demonstrated that she really believes in her own testimony, in that case, we believe her for her sister-in-law also. But if she's not putting herself at risk, then we assume that any testimony she's giving is really might be there to mess over her sister-in-law, and therefore we wouldn't believe her. So those are the two possibilities. Either that Rabbi Elazar says that she is believed if her sister-in-law is only an ancillary beneficiary, and the other one is she's believed with her sister-in-law if she puts her, you know, her money where her mouth is, so to speak, that she put herself at risk through her own testimony. So the Gemara asks, "L'may nafka mina, what difference does it make which of these two reasons it is?" So we said, "Yes, elan suve letzara mikame dida." So the case here is as follows: a woman went overseas with her husband, and there was a tzara, another wife. That wife stayed home. So the woman goes overseas with the husband. She comes back and says the husband died, and she wants to get remarried. So basically, I'll say it outside, then we'll do it inside. So she wants to get remarried. So since in this case her primary purpose of giving the testimony to say her husband died is so that she could be free to get remarried, so therefore her sister-in-law would be the ancillary her tzara in this case, her co-wife, would be the ancillary beneficiary, because if we believe her to say that her husband died, then obviously the tzara's husband also died. But if we say that she has to, the only reason Rebbe Elazar says she's believed is if she, by her actions, demonstrates that she believes in her own testimony, that she puts her money where her mouth is, then what would need to happen is she would need to actually go and get remarried. So if she went and got remarried, everyone, under either reason, we would believe her, whether because her tzara is just an ancillary beneficiary or because she put her money where her mouth is and went and got remarried. But that would be the difference. So if we agree with the first reason, then the tzara is only released when the first woman, the woman who went overseas with the husband, actually goes and gets married. According to the first reason, we would not require that. We would not require actual marriage. According to the first reason, according to the second reason, we would require actual marriage. So that's what it says. L'ansuve letzara mekame dida. For the tzara to get married before this woman, the woman who actually went overseas with the husband and testified. I amrit tzara me'ida l'chaverta. If you say that a woman is believed with her tzara, if her tzara is just an ancillary beneficiary of her testimony, then afagav delay insiv, then even though the woman who went overseas didn't actually go and get married, minasbinon la l'tzara, we allow the tzara to get remarried because she's only an ancillary beneficiary and we believe her. I amrit, but on the other hand, if we say mishum dehilai mekalkul nafsha, if the reason Rebbe Elazar said his halacha in the Mishnah is because she wouldn't mess herself over, and therefore she demonstrated by her actions that she believes in her testimony, insiv minasbinon la l'tzara, that insiv, if she gets married, minasbinon la l'tzara, then only if she gets married, we allow the tzara to get remarried. Ilo insiv, but if she doesn't get married, lo minasbinon la, we wouldn't allow her to get married. So that's the question. Do we require just the testimony or actual marriage? So that's the distinction. So now what we're going to do is to try and figure out in the Gemara, what is the halacha? What's the rationale for Rebbe Elazar's halacha when he says that when women 1 and 2 get married to brothers 3 and 4, that at that point, even when brothers 3 and 4 die, they're not back in their original problem and they can go and get remarried. So, Tashma, we're about 5 lines down at the end of the line. Tashma, Rebbe Elazar Amar, we're going to quote from our Mishnah itself. Rebbe Elazar says, Ho v'hutru liyabmin, once they went ahead and married brothers 3 and 4, Hutru l'chol adam, that therefore they can at that point marry any person. So iyamrit bishloma dehila mekalkul nafsha. If the reason that we say Rebbe Elazar says is halacha is because he says the woman's not going to mess herself over, haynu dechi insiv minas binan la. That's the reason that if in this case where the brothers went ahead and married brothers 3 and 4, that's the case we believe them because they went and took an action. But in the first case in the Mishnah, where there was no brothers 3 and 4, we don't say that we believe them. So it makes sense if it's the second reason, that the reason Rebbe Elazar trusts them is because she did something, actions that demonstrated that she believed in her own testimony. That's why it makes a difference, and the last case in the Mishnah is different than the first case. If the reason is simply because when a woman testifies and her sister-in-law or Tzara is an ancillary beneficiary, then why did we need to wait for the case at the end of the Mishnah where they married brothers 3 and 4, afagav de lo insiv? Even if they hadn't married brothers 3 and 4, nami, they should also be believed because their primary purpose in giving their testimony is to release themselves from their husband, not to testify about their sister-in-law. So, elashmamina, we should learn from there, from the language, from the fact that Rabbi Elazar only argues in the last case, but not in the first case. We should learn from there that time of the Rabbi Elazar, mishum de insiv hu, v'loy mekalkal anafsha. That the, basically, it should be the second reason that we demonstrated that Rabbi Elazar must hold that the reason it makes a difference when they marry brothers 3 and 4 is because she put her money where her mouth is and demonstrated by her actions that that she believes her own testimony. So the Gemara answers and says, no, it's not necessarily a proof. Perhaps Rabbi Elazar was just saying l'divrayim. He was saying according to the Chachamim. Rabbi Elazar l'divrayim kamar luhu. He was saying to them according to your words. He says, maybe Rabbi Elazar is of the opinion l'didi, according to me, tzara me'idu l'chaverto. As long as it's the tzara is simply an ancillary beneficiary, then the woman is going to be believed. But the afag abdolay insav minas binanla, and even if she didn't go ahead and get married, we would still allow the tzara to get remarried because basically she's believed on the testimony with or without an action. That's the Rabbi Elazar saying, that's my own opinion. El lididhu, according to you, odoli mihas dehecha de insav minas binanla, misham dehila mekalko nafsha. He says, basically, even I believe that she should be believed, period. But surely in a case where she put actions behind her words and she went ahead and married brother 3 on the basis of her own testimony, in that case, even you, Rabbanon, should agree that we would believe her and allow her to get remarried. So that's Rabbi Elazar. So with what the Gemara is saying is Rabbi Elazar really, you can't prove anything about his own opinion. He was just speaking to the Rabbanon. So then the question is, why is that not a good taina? So the Rabbanon, why didn't the Rabbanon buy Rabbi Elazar's argument and say, since she took actions that demonstrated the truth of her words, we should believe her? So it's because Tamas Nafshi Implishtim Hu. I'm sorry, Tamas Nafshi Implishtim Hu de Kavda, that she did a case of Tamas Nafshi Implishtim, which we talked about also a couple of blot ago, and that was the case with Shimshon, that he basically was willing to get himself killed to accomplish his goal of killing all of those Plishtim who are in the building together with him. So similar concept that the woman, the Rabbanan say, a woman could be sufficiently vengeful, spiteful, jealous, whatever the word is, that she would even be willing to mess herself over in order to mess over her sister-in-law or her tzara. And therefore, we, A, don't believe her when she says, even if it's only an ancillary benefit, and even if she took action to back up her words, we still don't believe her. So that's the Rabbanan's view. So basically, the effort to bring a raya from our Mishnah as to what Rabbi Elazar's reason is was unsuccessful because we said maybe Rabbi Elazar was only speaking, saying, according to you, the Rabbanan. So the Gemara continues, Tashma, we're going to try another case. And this is, again, a case that we learned on Kuf Yud Ches. Ha'isha shahalcha hi ubala l'medinat hayam. A woman went with her husband overseas. Uba v'amra meis bali. And she comes back and says, I was overseas with the husband and my husband died. So the Gemara, the halacha was tinase, she can get remarried, v'tito ksubasa, and she could take her ksuba. Basically, we believe her. V'tzarasa asura, but her tzara is asur. And we learned the reason is because we believe her for herself, but for her tzara, we're worried that maybe she gave testimony that was really designed to mess over her tzara. And in that case, Rabbi Elazar says, hayo v'hutra hi, hutra nami tzarasa. He says, basically, since we believe her for herself and we allow her to get remarried, we're not going to leave the tzara and say that the tzara can't get remarried, and therefore we allow both of them to get remarried. So basically what we're trying to prove from there is it looks like, pretty much according to Rabbi Elazar, that once we say the woman can get remarried, we say her tzara can get remarried. It doesn't say they have to get married first. It doesn't say they have to take action to demonstrate her words. It sounds like it's believed, and therefore that would be the first of the possible reasons for Rabbi Elazar, which basically is saying that as long as the sister-in-law, their tzara, is simply an ancillary beneficiary, we would believe her. So the Gemara says, no, Ema, when Rabbi Elazar says, ho v'hutra hi, since she's permitted, it says, ho v'hutra, since she's permitted, vin nises, and she actually gets married. So say, no, maybe what he means is if she actually gets married and therefore puts action behind her words, in that case we'll believe her, but we won't believe her generally. Now the Gemara is going to get sidetracked for a minute with this particular case and demonstrated, but this is basically the conclusion of the Gemara, is we don't know, we don't demonstrate one way or another why Rebbe Elazar has his opinion. But the Gemara is going to say, the Gemara is going to ask a question on this, because basically what we're saying is she needs to get married. So the Gemara is going to say, if you tell me that we believe her in all cases and where it's an ancillary benefit and we're not worried that she's going to try and mess over her sister-in-law, this case makes sense. But if you say we're worried that she might be trying to mess over her sister-in-law, then why in this case, even where she gets married, does it help the matter? Why? Because he says, "V'leichush doma begita asoy." Maybe she came with a get. V'haide ka'amra hachi lekalkul atzari himekavna. That maybe the reason she testified this way is to mess over her tzara. So let's explain what this is talking about. Woman went overseas with her husband. The husband says, "You're a miserable woman. Here's a get," and divorces her. She goes back and she's like, "All right, fine. This guy divorced me, but now I'm going to go back and have it for my tzara. I'm going to go back and say the husband died." Because why? She's like, "I'm happy to get remarried. And if the husband ever shows up, I'll just show that he really divorced me. But the tzara is going to go and get remarried, and she's not going to have a get, and then she's going to be messed over." So if you tell me we don't worry that when the woman's focus is for herself, we're not worried about her tzara or her sister-in-law, that's fine. So we believe her. But if you're saying we require marriage because that puts action behind words, what's the proof? Because in this case, she could do action. She could go get remarried. But really, she's allowed to get remarried. Her tzara is not allowed to get remarried. So if you're right that Rebbe Elazar is of the opinion that we just believe her, then what difference does marriage make or not make? So we say, so the Gemara says, Enachinami. So if we're understanding that case, if it could be a case where she could get married beheter and her tzara would be getting married beisr, then Enachinami, we wouldn't believe her. So what's the case? That's true. If she went ahead and married a Yisrael, which at the end, if the husband shows up, she could simply show a get, then we wouldn't allow her to get remarried. What case are we talking about here that we allow her to get remarried? The insiv l'kayin, that she married a kohen. Because if she went and married a kohen, a divorcee is not allowed to marry a kohen. As we know, a gerusha can't marry a kohen. So therefore, if the husband shows up, she's going to actually be messed over. Because the husband is going to show up and we're going to say, "Well, you weren't allowed to get remarried to a kohen because you're a gerusha." So in that case, where she put actions behind her words in a way that she would be messed over if the husband showed up, then we believe her for the tzara also, even because we say that she's not going to mess herself up simply to get at the tzara. But if it is a scenario where she could get remarried and she's fine and the tzara will be messed over, then in fact we would not believe her in that case. Rebbe Elazar would not believe her. So it could in fact be that Rebbe Elazar says it depends on whether she gets married. What he's really saying is it depends on whether she gets married in a way that she'll be messed over also. If she'll be messed over also, we believe her, and if not, not. So therefore, we end the Gemara with no proof one way or another as to what Rebbe Elazar's reason is. It's one of those two reasons, either because we believe in a case of ancillary benefit, or we believe only in a case where she took action to back up her words and her testimony. We are now going to shift topics, new Mishnah, shift topics to something totally different altogether. And this has to do with when we talk about someone saying that a person died. For example, we've been talking about it for a while with people come and say the husband died somewhere and testify and she gets remarried. What exactly do you need to testify, do you need to know in order to establish that someone's dead? This is whether we're talking about two aid and whether we're talking about one aid, whatever it is, what do you need to know? For example, these are very relevant halachas, like in 9/11 you had this. You had people who disappeared, and what level of certainty do you need as to whether they died? These are questions that come up on a regular basis, and that's what this Mishnah deals with. So the Mishnah starts, Ein me'idin ela al partzuf panim imachotem. That we don't testify about someone that they died unless the witnesses or whoever saw it saw the shape of their face with the nose. And we're going to see in the Gemara is going to establish that this is talking about basically the cheeks and the forehead. That's enough to recognize a person. For example, the eyes don't need to be there, the mouth doesn't need to be there, but you at least need to see the tzura of the face in order to establish that someone died. Even if the body, if there are other simanim, meaning you didn't recognize the person, let's say someone was unfortunately burned or something, so you couldn't see that part of their body, but you saw something else, either maybe the clothing that was being worn or a necklace or something or some identifying mark on the body, so the Mishnah says that doesn't work. You actually need to see and recognize the person. We'll see that this is going to get modified a little bit in the Gemara, but in theory, what the Mishnah is saying, the only thing that works is if you recognize the person by seeing the cheeks and the forehead. Okay, now, next halacha. Ein me'idin ela asher teitzei nafsho. You don't, a person can't testify that someone died unless they actually see them dead. What does that mean? Vafilu ra'u meguyed. Even if you see the person, meguyed, Rashi learns is basically like, you know, he got stabbed a bunch of times. You see him full of, fatal, you know, wounds, that in gushing blood. And basically, even if you saw that, if you didn't see that the person died and stopped breathing or whatever, that's insufficient. But Salov, even if you saw the person hanging on a noose, and they were sitting there hanging and you can be pretty sure they were going to die momentarily, but the witness left before they saw him dead, that's insufficient. V'achaya o'chelespo, or if a wild animal was eating, you know, a bear was mauling a person and the guy didn't want to stick around because he's worried he was next, so he runs away. And he tries to testify, they say, no, if you didn't see him actually dead with the act finally finished, then we don't believe you. Okay, that's the second halacha. Now the third halacha in the Mishnah, Ein me'idin ela ad gimel yamin. Basically you can testify within the first 3 days. After the first 3 days, we're worried that maybe the dead person changed his appearance as there's decomposition of the body or whatever happens to the body, and we're worried that if it's not within 3 days, the identification, that it's no longer accurate identification. Rabbi Huda ben Bava says, Lo kala adam, lo kala makam, lo kala shos shavim. Not every person and not every place and not every time is equal. The Gemara is going to discuss tomorrow's daf about whether he's saying this to be more strict, to say less than 3 days, or saying even if it's more than 3 days. But he says, for example, you know, a fat person will decompose differently than a skinny person. If someone's outside versus inside, they'll decompose differently. If it's the summer versus the winter, there's a difference. So that was basically Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava saying you can't say 3 days as a categorical rule. It depends because decomposition changes based on the circumstances or the environment where the person is. Okay. Tan Rabbanan, I referenced this brisa before. It says padachas below parts of panim. If you can see on the dead person the forehead, but you can't see the cheeks, or parts of panim, you can see the cheeks, but like padachas, but you can't see the forehead. Ein me'idin, you can't testify achi yehu shneim imachotam until you have both cheeks and forehead together with the nose. In that case, the Mishnah is saying you can recognize the person. Short of having those features, we're worried that maybe you'll make a mistake in identification. Okay. Rabbi Timur of Kahana. Abaya says, and others say, Rav Kahana, my crow, what's the pasuk? So this is a pasuk in Yeshayahu. It says, Akaris Pneim Ansabam V'chatasam Kistoim Hegidu. What it's talking about is talking there about the Yidden that Kali saw were doing bad things. And it says, the recognition of their faces answers for them and their sins are told, etc. But the point is, Hakaras Pneim, the recognition of their faces, Ansabam. So we learn from there that Hakaras Panim, you need recognition of a face. Rashi learns his face. Generally, Tosus understands that from those words, you're actually seeing this halacha of padachas and partsuf. So that's the pasuk. Then the Gemara is going to say a story to demonstrate this point. It says, Abba Bar Marta, dehu Abba Bar Manyume, that Abba Bar Marta, who is also known as Abba Bar Manyume, having maski bay de resha galusa zuzi, that he owed money to people in the house of the Resh Galusa, who was the head over there in Babel. I see Kira. He took some wax or sticky substance. Dabek b'valyusa. He attached it to a cloth or a rag. And dabek b'apuse. He stuck it on his forehead or on his face. And chalav kamayu passed in front of them v'lod b'shakrua, and they didn't recognize him. So the point is that if someone covers their forehead, that's enough that people won't recognize him. So therefore, when we're looking at a dead body, if you can't see the forehead, we're worried that you might not be able to accurately identify the person. Okay. So now the Mishnah said that we don't rely on simanim. It says we can only rely if you see the face, even if there are simanim in the guf or in the clothing. So we talked about maybe, you know, that there was a necklace or a mole or something like that. That our Mishnah says you cannot rely on. So the Gemara says, "Lemeimer de simanim lav deoraisa." Are you saying that simanim is not deoraisa? This is a reference to an issue, a machlokas we have. Rashi brings, there's a limud we have in Bab Metzia, which has to do with the fact we know that if someone loses an object, I lose this box of tissues, and I say, well, I had a marking, I had written, I doodled a box on there. So that's considered a simon, and we believe the person, and we in fact return the item. The question the Gemara has is, is that deoraisa, that mid deoraisa you have to return something when someone can identify a simen? Or is it the Rabbanim? What would be the point of the Rabbanim? Because if you don't rely on Simanim, then every single thing, you'd need to have witnesses come and say, this is my box of tissues. How do they know? So in very few instances would you actually return things. So that's why we rely on Simanim. So the question is it Deoraisa that we rely on Simanim, or is it only the Rabbanim? What would be the difference? The difference would be something like identifying a dead person, or as you will see in a minute, we'll talk about cases of Gittin. So if it's a Deoraisa Dekadin, and we're talking about Isurim, so then it makes a huge difference whether it's Deoraisa or Derabanan that we rely on Simanim. Because if it's Deoraisa, then even in a case of Gittin or to allow a woman to get remarried, then we'll rely on Simanim. If it was just Derabanan by Mitzias, so we know Hefker, Bezin, Hefker, so therefore Bezin, Derabanan can say, even though theoretically you can keep this box of tissues, we're going to say that you have to give it back because Hefker, Bezin, Hefker, but it wouldn't work in a case of Isser, like identifying someone who's dead. So it makes a big difference whether Simanim are Deoraisa or not. So it seems from our Mishnah, it says that even though the person has Simanim, you have to see the face and the forehead. It doesn't help to have Simanim. So that would seem to say that Simanim are not Deoraisa. It only works in a case of lost objects, but it wouldn't work in a Deoraisa Dikadin of Isser, like allowing a woman to get remarried. But the Gemara says, Raminu, I'll ask you, we say, okay, this price needs a little bit of explanation. Basically, let's say you had a witness. You had a shliach who had a get, and the man said, here, deliver this to my wife, the get. He goes home, he runs somewhere, and he says, oh no, where did I put the get? He looks around his house and he finds it. That's fine. Even though he lost it for a little bit, he can go and take it to the woman and divorce her. But if, let's say, he lost it for an extended period of time, he's searching high and low, he can't find it, and then whatever it is, 3 weeks later, he finds it. So in that case, you can't use the get anymore because we're worried that even though the get has names in it and everything, maybe there are people with similar names in similar cities, and it's not really the get that he lost, and therefore he can't rely on to use it. So that's the basic halacha. But the Braisa says, matzav kosher bekis uv arniki uv tabas. It says, but let's say he was missing the get for like weeks or months on end, and then eventually he found that it was tied to his kis, is like a money bag or something, arniki is a wallet, tabas, he had his signet ring that he used to sign papers with. If it was attached to there, Osha Nimsa Ben Kalev, or it was found amongst his personal effects, then afilu's man muruba, even though it had been lost for some number of weeks or months, kasher, he's allowed to use it. So basically, the halacha is as follows. It's not just that he says, I recognize my stuff. The point is, once there were Edim that said it was lost, its halacha is it's lost. So in order for him to be able to use it, he needs to demonstrate that that was with my money bag. How does he demonstrate his money bag or his wallet? He gives Simanim. He says, so we would see a case where we rely on Simanim, which then allows the Shaliach to rely that it's the same get and deliver it to the woman. So if we didn't believe that Simanim were Midaraisa, we would never rely on these Simanim to allow the Shliach to deliver the get to the woman and have her be divorced, which is obviously a Deoraisa Dekadin. So we see a case that it seems that there are Simanim are Deoraisa. So Rabaya, Lo Kasha, it's not a Kasha, you're right. That Braisa does indeed seem to say that Simanim are Deoraisa. Harav Elazar bar Mavoi, Harabanan. That there's a Machlokas. The Sa'ar Mishnah is like the Rabbanan who say we don't rely on Simanim Midaraisa. And the Braisa was going like Rabbi Lazar ben Ma'avoy, who says we do rely on Simanim. Why? The Sanya, because we see in a Braisa, Ein me'idin al shuma, that you can't, this is going back to our case of identifying a dead person. Let's say someone has a mole. The Rabbanan say you can't testify based on, say, I see that guy has a mole on his forehead, I recognize that mole. So it doesn't make a difference. That's not sufficient. You need to see his cheeks and his forehead and his nose. Rabbi Lazar ben Ma'avoy amr me'idin, that you do testify. My lab bahakum mifugi. Isn't it that we're talking about this? That mar saver simanim deraisa, mar saver simanim derabanan. That Rabbi Lazar ben Ma'avoy says simanim are deraisa, and the Rabbanan says simanim are only derabanan, and therefore you wouldn't use it in a case of get. So therefore, what we're suggesting is the way we'll answer the fact that our Mishnah seems to say we don't rely on simanim, and that Braisa seems to say we do rely on simanim, is because it's two different people. One is the Rabbanan, our Mishnah, and Rabbi Lazar ben Ma'avoy is the other view, is the view of the Braisa. Now we're going to say a series of reasons to say that no, maybe they really, everyone agrees on this, and there's not, it's not the difference between the Braisa and the Mishnah is something different. It's not just, it's not a machlokas between two different people. Amar Rava. Rava says, Dukule yamo simanim deraisa. Maybe everyone holds that simanim are deraisa, and we do rely on them. Hacha b'shuma mitziyah b'bengilo kamifugi. What we're talking about here is the following. Bengilo is like someone who the son of his luck or something. It means basically, let's say, people who share a constellation, they were born at the same time or under the same astronomical things, are likely to have similar marks. So let's say that what they're arguing about is when they have that mole on the forehead, is that something that most people born when he's born have that mark? And therefore, if we see the mark, it doesn't prove that it's him. Maybe it's someone else who was born in the same mazel. And the other one holds, then no, that's, you know, if you see a mole, it's a mole. There's no such thing that they necessarily have the same mole with the people who are born at the same time. So Hacha b'shuma mitzuyah b'vengila kamifagimar saver, one holds shuma mitzuyah b'vengila, that in fact similar marks are found by people who are born at similar times, and therefore you can't rely on the mark. Umar saver ain't a mitzuyah b'vengila, that's not, you don't find the same mark. V'ikadamri, so now that was one reason to say that they're not, it's not arguing the Braisa and Mishnah could be, it wouldn't depend on Simanim Deraisa or not, it would depend on this question of, do you say that the mark is a good mark? V'ikadamri, and there are others that say, everyone agrees that Simanim are Deraisa, and everyone agrees that someone who's born at the same time could have the same mark. But there's going to be a difference in the mark because the color, even if someone is born at the same time, they might have a similar mark, but it's not the same. And you could use a mark as an identifying factor, but what are they arguing about here? They're arguing about b'shuma ha'suyi l'hishtana islachar misa kamifagi. They're arguing about, does this mark change its appearance after the guy dies? So in other words, it's saying, when the two people are alive, you could look and see the difference between the mole that they each have, even though they were born at the same time and have a similar mole. But once the guy dies, it could shift in its color or appearance. It could shift to a point that it looks like the other guy, and therefore maybe we'll be making a mistaken identification. Mar Savar Asu Yilishtanas, Lacha Misa. One says they do change after Misa, or Mar Savar Ena Asu Yilishtanas, Lacha Misa. They don't change after Misa. So we gave two reasons to say that it's not necessarily a machlokas about whether Simanim are Daraisa. Maybe everyone holds Simanim are Daraisa. Now we're going to say a third reason to explain why they're not arguing about Simanim Deraisa or not. So the first two said that everyone agrees that Simanim are Deraisa. This answer is going to say, no, everyone agrees that Simanim are Derabanan. The Ikadami, there are those that say, Amar Rava, Rava said, the Kuli Amma Simanim Derabanan. Everyone agrees that Simanim are only Derabanan, and Mid Deraisa, Simanim don't work. So the reason it works by Metzia is because the Rabbanim Hefker Bezin Hefker. Tosus explains, it will make more sense in a minute, about why the case of Get and Arniki and etc., which is a Deraisa de Kedin, still works, even though Simanim are not Deraisa. But basically we're saying, everyone agrees Simanim are Derabanan, V'hacha b'shuma simen muvak kamifagi. Mar Tzavar, one holds that shuma, that a mole is a simen muvak, like you have a Talmud muvak or Rabbi muvak is, you know, like a dedicated or specific, unique. So Marzavar Simon Muvak, Marzavar Lab Simon Muvak. So the question is, so basically what we learn from this Gemara, the Gemara is introducing a concept that there are different kinds of Simanim. There are Simanim that are like general Simanim, like I doodled something on this tissue box, that could be one kind. And then there are ones that are so clear that even though regularly Simanim are not Deraisa, regular markings on something is not Deraisa, but when it's so clear, even mid-Deraisa, you have that. So, like, for example, I haven't learned the sugya myself, but I would venture to guess that nowadays we do, like, DNA testing on a body part, right? That's probably a simen muvak, because it's a really strong fact that we can establish, and that would probably be, you know, be relevant in today's cases. And, in fact, I know of cases where they did rely on DNA testing of a body part that they were able to recover. So what we're introducing here is saying, really, everyone agrees that simanim generally are derabanan. By a simen muvok, in that case, if it's a truly unique simen, then we'll rely on it. And that is how we explain that they're not really arguing. So now the Gemara is going to say, okay, we just gave three answers. The first two assume that everyone agrees that simanim are deraisa, and the last one assumed that everyone agrees that simanim are derabanan. It says, ulahach lishon adama rava simanim deraisa. Let's ask a question according to the two versions that said that Rava said that everyone agrees that Simanim are Daraisa. Hakatani, we learned in our Mishnah, Afal Pisha Yesh Simanim Begufo Bekelov, that even though we don't rely on Simanim that were on the guf or on the, you know, let's say the clothing or necklace, whatever, so we say in our Mishnah, it seems to imply that Simanim are not Deraisa, because of Simanim, if everyone agrees that Simanim are Deraisa, why can't you rely on the body of the person or on their clothing? It would seem to say that Simanim are not Deraisa. So the Gemara says, no, it's now going to introduce a third category of simanim. It says gufo, when it says that there's a simon in his guf, it means the aruch, the guts, that he's long or short. And when it says kalov, it means the chashinun l'sheila. He says, so now we're going to introduce a third set. So we talked about before, there's basic simanim, which, according to some views, might be d'oraisa or d'rabanan. There's a simon muvuk, which is like a really strong simon. And then there's like simanim that are irrelevant because they're so common. So to say he was about 6 foot tall, so therefore this dead guy must be him because the dead guy's also 6 foot tall, that's not a very good proof. It's an irrelevant proof. So he's saying, when our Mishnah said we don't rely on proofs, it was saying you don't rely on irrelevant proofs. So what would that be for the body? Body might be height. What does it mean when it says we don't rely on kalim, that what the person is wearing? Again, it's because it's an irrelevant simon, like, for example, that he was wearing a white shirt. But he might have borrowed it from the dead guy. Who said it's the dead guy himself? So the point is that what we're answering is the way we would explain our Mishnah, even if you want to say that simanim are daraisa, the reason our Mishnah doesn't rely on it is because it's talking about this third category of simanim that are just meaningless simanim. So that's that. Now the Gemara is going to go off on a slight tangent here and say, is it true that we worry that we, in other words, why did we say we discount the fact that he's wearing a white shirt? Because maybe he borrowed the white shirt from the dead guy, and it's a dead guy's shirt, but maybe he just borrowed it. So the Gemara is going to ask, if we in fact are concerned at times that people might have borrowed something, that creates a whole host of problems in other scenarios. So like, for example, the Ichashin and L'Sheila, if we worry that people borrowed something, Chamar b'simani alkev heichim adrinon, so this is talking about a case. Let's say you find a donkey walking around, and you don't know whose it is, and the donkey has a saddle. And the owner comes and says, look, it has my name on the saddle. So the donkey, now they have no simon in the donkey. The halacha is you give him back the donkey, because we assume if the saddle says his name, then the saddle's his, so then the donkey's also his. But the question is, if we acknowledge the possibility that people could borrow something from someone else, maybe the donkey belongs to someone else, and the guy borrowed this guy's saddle. So it doesn't make it his donkey. It is his saddle, but it's not his donkey. So the Gemara says, lo shayli inshi ukva de maskivle lechamra. People don't lend a saddle. Why? Because a saddle is like very specific to an animal. And if you're going to take a saddle that's used for one animal, stick it on another animal, it's going to basically chafe the skin of the chamor. So therefore, people don't. Basically, saddles are custom fit for donkeys, and they don't lend it for a different donkey. So therefore, if this donkey has this saddle, it must be his. So then the Gemara says, well, okay, what about matza kasher bekis ubarniki betabat? So it says, but if you're right that we worry that people might have borrowed something, so when we said in the case of get, that if you found the get that had been missing for a while, but it was tied to his money bag or his wallet or his ring, so why don't you say maybe someone borrowed his ring and tied the get to it, but it's not the get he had. So the Gemara says, no, because tabas chayish leziufe, that people don't lend out their rings. You know, because like you see it in the story with Purim, Achashverosh, he gives out the ring. If you have the ring, you could put any edict of the king. So people don't lend their rings because they're worried a guy's going to make a copy or he's going to take it, and while he has it, he's going to sign things on your behalf, take out mortgages and do things. So you don't lend the ring. So therefore, if you find a get tied to someone's ring, you know that it was his and it wasn't lent to someone else. And what about kisvarniki, his money bag or his wallet? Menachashi inshi v'loy maishli. This is an interesting thing. People are menachish. We saw this, like, for example, by Yosef HaTzadik, and, you know, that he does his divinations or whatever. But this thing, basically, that there's superstition. People are worried, if I give someone my wallet, I'm giving him away my mazel, my good mazel, and he's going to end up with my mazel. So people are superstitious about this. They don't lend their wallets. So that's why when you find the get tied to the wallet, you can rely on it, and you don't assume that maybe it got borrowed. Okay, so now we finished this thing establishing that borrowing is not a problem, and that's the reason our Mishnah says you don't rely on simanim or guf, because it's talking about this category of irrelevant simanim. But if, let's say, guf would be a mole or something that is kind of unique, then we would rely. Now the Gemara is going to go back and give a different teretz to the original question of, if simanim are deraisa, why does our Mishnah say that that you don't rely on the kalim? He says, so we reestablished the Mishnah and said, when it said don't rely on simanim in the guf or the kalim, the guf we said is tall or short. Kalim, we said maybe it's borrowed. That's why we don't rely on kalim. The Gemara is now going to say, no, maybe kalim was similar to guf, whereas you gave an in, a non-descriptive thing. Like you said, the shirt was white. You didn't even prove it was his. So in other words, everyone, lots of people have white shirts. It doesn't prove anything. So it's the same category as goof. Just like tall or short is not a good siman. Red or black or white is also not a good siman. Meaning, so our Mishnah, so we could all agree that simanim are deraisa. The fact that our Mishnah said we don't rely on simanim was talking about this third category of simanim that are just basically meaningless simanim. Those are the things we don't really care about. Okay. Fine. Now we're going to go back to the Mishnah talked about the fact that if you see someone, even if you see him basically chopped up with a bunch of sword holes in him, that you still, you cannot assume that he's going to die, and you have to actually know that he's dead. If you don't know that he's dead, then we can't tell the woman that she could get remarried. Okay, so Lameimra, this is to suggest, if our Mishnah says it's insufficient if you see him, you know, full of holes, Lameimra, that's to say, the Meguyed Chayai, that someone who's chopped up this way could actually live. And that's a problem. Raminu, I'll ask you from the Brisa, I'm sorry, it's a Mishnah, I think, in Oilos, where it says, Adam enam etama ashetetze nafsho, that a person, so in other words, we know that a dead body is creates tumah. So it says a person doesn't do tumah until they actually die. Afilu meguyed, even if he's chopped up the way we've talked about, afilu goses, he's about to die. So what does it say? It says tamuye la metame. He's not metame. Hamachaya lo chaya. But we don't assume that he's going to live. We assume for sure he's going to die. So in other words, because to tell us that if the guy, you know, cut his finger, that he's not metame mesim, you understand, because a finger, you know, a paper cut doesn't kill someone. So we must be talking about a case where he's basically for sure going to die. And we see that the Mishnah says he's not metame, but it's not like we think that he could possibly live. And that's why the Mishnah brings an example of Meguyed where he's chopped up. So we see that someone who's chopped up cannot live. So why did our Mishnah seem to say we can't rely on the fact that he's chopped up in order to release his wife to get remarried? It seems like someone who's chopped in this way is for sure going to die. Amar Abaya, Abaya says, well, Kasha, you're right. Those are Stira. Harav Shimon ben Elazar, Harabanan. That there's two opinions. Our Mishnah, which says you don't rely on the fact that someone's chopped up, is Rav Shimon ben Elazar. And it's the Rabbanan are the ones who say that he's for sure going to die. The Sanya, because we learned, Me'idin alamaguyid, that you can testify on someone, I'm sorry, I said it the opposite way, but Me'idin alamaguyid, you could testify that someone was chopped up, and even if you didn't see him absolutely dead, we're positive he's going to die, and therefore the wife can get remarried. Ve'ein Me'idin alatzalov, but that doesn't extend to someone you see him hanging on a noose, if he's not yet dead, because maybe someone's going to come and snip the rope, and then it's very easy to see that he'll live. But if someone's already chopped up and full of sword holes, they're not going to recover. Rav Shimon ben Elazar says, Afal Maguyid, even if you see someone chopped up with all these holes or something has been cut off from him, Ein Me'idin, we can't testify that the guy is dead. Because basically he can burn it and it'll live. I'm sorry? Cauterized, correct. So in other words, you know, basically what you have is, and in the olden days they used this a lot. Well, if they did an amputation or something, they would cauterize, which is like basically burn the end of the thing. In many cases, they thought it was good for infection. Nowadays, medicine believes that it actually creates infection. But to this day, you have this, people use cauterization for cutting off moles or other things like this. So it's basically, Rav Shimon Elazar says, even if the guy has these big holes in him, maybe they're going to take like a hot iron or something and put it on him, and that's going to cauterize the skin, and then he's not going to die. So it's going to prevent him from dying. So we see, so it says, Rav Shimon Elazar Amar, Afal Maguyed Einu Me'idin, you can't testify, even if you see the guy chopped up, you can't testify, because maybe he's going to get cauterized. Okay, so now we've explained that our Mishnah is Rav Shimon ben Elazar, who says that maybe the guy could still live, and the Braisa, which said about Mitami Mesim, is the Rabbanan. But the problem with that is, if we say that our Mishnah is Rav Shimon ben Elazar, can you say that our Mishnah is like Rav Shimon ben Elazar? V'halkatani Seifa, we learned the Seifa, which is a Mishnah we're going to see tomorrow, and it tells you, Maisa be'isya, it happened a story in Isya be'echad, with a guy, Shishol Shaluhu Liyam, that they put him down into the sea, they put him in the ocean. They also be other melaraglo, and let's say they had him tied to a rope, they put him down, I don't know what he wants to do, go to the mikvah or something, and they pull back the rope, and all that's there is a leg. The guy is gone. and his leg is still there. V'amru chacham, and the chacham said, min arkuva l'mala tinase, from the knee and up, the woman, his wife, can get remarried, because we assume he couldn't have lived if his leg was chopped off above the knee. Min arkuva l'mata lo tinase. If it was from the knee and down, she can't get remarried, because people all the time live when they had a limb chopped off, as long as it was beneath the knee. So the issue is the following. If our Seifa says that when you end up with a foot that's chopped off above the knee, we assume the guy died, Rav Shimon ben Elazar, and that's the Seifa of our Mishnah, which we just said is Rav Shimon ben Elazar, Rav Shimon ben Elazar says you could cauterize something. So if you could cauterize where it got chopped off above the knee, then you'll cauterize it. So how could our Mishnah be Rav Shimon ben Elazar in the Reisha if in the Seifa you see that he doesn't account for cauterization? So the Gemara says, Shani Maya Demarzu Maka. That in that case, where the guy's sitting in the ocean, you can't cauterize, because basically you cauterize with heat. If the guy's sitting in the water, Rashi says, the water agitates the wound, it doesn't make it better, and you can't cauterize in the middle of the ocean. So really it is Rav Shimon ben Elazar. He would agree with that story in the Seifa, because that's not a case where you can cauterize. V'ha'amar Rabba Bar Bar Chana, but I'll ask you a different thing, because we saw Rabba Bar Bar Chana, L'didi chazili, he said, I saw it myself, Ahu Taya, there was this Arab, the Shakel, so evidently ISIS wasn't early on this stuff, there was a certain Arab, the Shakel, Safsira, the guy de la Gamle, he basically took a sword and he chopped off the leg of his camel, above the knee, V'loi afsikte l'naruse, basically that the animal started braying, and before it could even finish making that sound, it was dead, meaning that when you chop off something above the knee, that it almost immediately dies. So we see basically that chopping off something above that point, you see that someone dies immediately, or in the case of an animal. So Amrabaya hahi kechisha hava. That was a wimpy camel in that particular case. But a strong camel or a strong person, in fact, could withstand this. And if you have cauterization, would in fact be able to survive. And that's why our Mishnah says that you can't rely on seeing someone chopped up to assume that they're dead. You actually have to know they're dead. So we asked the question because our Mishnah seems to say that you assume could live. And the Mishnah about Tumah seems to say that a Meguyid can't live. So we're going to give we give an answer that says one is the Rabbanan, one is the Rishon ben Elazar. Rishon ben Elazar. Now we're going to say that no. They're not really a stira. What's the difference? Rava Omer, Rava says, Besakin Mulubenes Vidivakol. Actually, everyone could agree. And the difference between the two cases is if it had a boiling hot knife. So basically, this is a question of cauterization. So it's saying, if at the time that you cut is with a knife, so at the time they're cutting, it's basically cauterizing at the same time, so then everyone would agree the person could live. But if you cut with a knife and you're not cauterizing at the same time, you're only cauterized later, that gets into the machlokas of Rav Shimon. That would be the other case where you would say that in that case you assume that the person will in fact die. So that's how we're able to answer the stira between the brises. Okay, quickly, we're at the two dots. V'achayo chelas. This was another case in the Mishnah. So we said that a person can't testify and allow the woman to get remarried even if he's chopped up, even if he's hanging, and even if a wild animal was eating the guy. That's the case, you know, the guy saw his friend getting eaten by a bear, and he ran away, so he wouldn't get eaten. His testimony is no good. So I'm Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Lo Shana, we only learned this. Elomi makom she'en nafsho yotza. That's only true if the bear was eating the person's foot. But let's say it was eating the person's brain or heart, right? So something that a person can't live without that thing. So if the guy saw the bear actually eating the guy's skull, in that case you would believe him even if he didn't see the guy finally dead. And you see this, Shachet bo shnayim orov shnayim ubarach me'idin. So what's that talking about? Shnayim is talking about there's both in a person, an animal. We have this also shchita, basically has to go through the windpipe and the esophageal pipe or whatever it's called. That you need to go through both of those to do shchita, or at least rove of both of those. And the same is true with a person. So if you see that someone was beheading someone and they cut through those two things or most of those two things, and then the guy who got cut ran away. So even though he was able to run away, we assume he's going to die, Me'idin. We assume he's going to die, and that's because basically a person cannot live like that, which supports this argument that says that that if you see someone where it's nafsho yotza, that you can testify. So Eini, is that really so? So we say, well, that's very nice that you say that we assume that someone is dead once that they're shechted that amount through those two things. But what about, we have the following case where someone actually got sliced that way, someone basically beheaded him, but he was still alive, and he motioned that you should give his wife a get. And the shluchim say, fine, they're going to deliver a get, and they deliver a get before he dies. Why do they do that? Because they don't have to go through Yibum or whatever. They don't want to go through Chalitza and Yibum, so the guy was being nice to his wife. So what's the point? We assume that once someone is cut through those two pipes, they're basically a dead man. A dead man can't give a get. So why do we see in this case he can give a get? It must be that we think that the person can actually live despite this kind of injury. So the Gemara says, no. Chai hu v'sofo lamos. It's two different things. He's alive for purposes of giving a get, but he's still gonna die, so for purposes of testifying whether his wife can get remarried, he might stay alive long enough to issue a get, but he's gonna die, and therefore, if a week later we're testifying that his wife can get remarried, we assume she can get remarried because there's no way he could have lived. So the Gemara says, okay, so what you're telling me is that for sure someone who's gonna cut is gonna die. So what's it talking about? We know that if someone kills someone by accident, you run to Ari Miklat, and you stay there till Kohen Gadol dies, whatever. So the question is, let's say a person cuts another person through these two pipes, right? Does he have to go to does he have to go to Ari Miklat? And halacha is he doesn't. So it would seem to imply that cutting someone through these two pipes isn't necessarily going to kill him. So how could we say that automatically he can marry the wife? Because you see that a person doesn't have to go to Gullus for it. Alama Tanya, why did we learn in the Brisa, Shachat Shnaim or Rov Shnaim, if you shechted a person through these two pipes, or most of the two pipes, Hareza and Agoyla, the person doesn't go to Gullus. So it would seem to imply that someone is not necessarily going to die when that happens, and therefore you shouldn't permit his wife if you didn't actually see him dead. So we say, Ha'etmar Allah, Amr Rav Hoshaya, that Rav Hoshaya said, Hashinan Shema HaRuach, Bilbalasso, that we're worried that maybe the reason he's not chayev to run to Ari Miklat is because it is true that the guy's going to die, but in between the time that he gets shechted like that, the wind is a contributing factor, so the wind is going to contribute to mess up what's happening over there, and therefore this guy alone didn't kill him, it was him together with the wind. Inami Shema Ihu Kirev Misaso, or maybe the guy himself sped the death. Why? Because he's rolling around on the floor in pain from having his neck cut, and that rolling around contributes to the death. So that's the reason that the person doesn't have to go to Ari Miklat, is because there was some contributing factor other than him. But for sure, the guy's going to die. The question is, he's going to die. The question is, does he die automatically without anything further happening, or does he die that gets contributed by this? So the Gemara says, "My benai, what's the difference whether you're saying because he was rolling around or because the air did something?" The shachta bevesa de shisha uparchis. So one case would be what happens if you shecht him in a marble house, which the Gemara is basically saying is a case where there's no wind, uparchis, but he rolls around on the floor. So according to the second reason, the rolling around on the floor is sufficient to say the guy doesn't need to go to. So Ari Miklat. Inami the Shachti Bevara, or the other option is that the person shechted him outside, so there is the wind, Velo Parchis, but the guy doesn't move. So the question is, if the guy doesn't move and you say that the reason he doesn't go to Golos is because he moves, but in this case he didn't move, so then in fact he would have to go to Ari Miklat. But the point is, for sure the guy, one second because I'm going to finish, for sure the guy dies. The question only is, the question of Golos is a different question. Just like we said that the case of get also is he could be alive for purposes of get, but for purposes of his wife remarrying, he's going to be dead. Same thing here. For purposes of gullus, there might be wind, or he might roll around, which releases him from gullus, but that doesn't change the fact that he's for sure going to die, and therefore if we saw him in a scenario where he was cut through those two tubes, then in fact we would allow the wife to get remarried. I'm sorry.
I thought that's what I was going to say. Why don't you go rolling around? He's for sure going to die anyway.
Well, it's an interesting question because, for whatever reason, it seems that